Introduce yourself, please.
Hi, I'm State Representative Duron McGee, and I represent the 36th District in Kansas City, which is essentially South Kansas City.
Very good. Let's play the open.
This is Statehouse Blend. I'm Sam Zeff.
And I'm Brian Ellison. We're using coffee
and donuts
to better understand the legislatures on both sides of the state line,
the issues and the people in Topeka
and Jeff City. Here we go. Welcome to the production studio at KCUR 89.3. I'm Brian Ellison, and I am here today for Statehouse Blend with Representative Duron McGee, a Democrat of the southern part of Kansas City, and also Dylan Little, our citizen guest. He works at Mid-Continent Library. Welcome to you, Dylan.
Thank you very much.
Glad you're here. Duron, we always start by asking you to tell us a little about your family and your pets, if you have any.
Okay. My family, I am the oldest of three. My parents still live in Kansas City. They actually live in my district in South Kansas City. That's where I grew up.
It's kind of nice to get to represent your parents.
Well, I have a two for one. I represent not only my parents, but I represent my grandparents. They all live in my district.
Wow.
It's where I grew up. So I went to elementary school there. It's where I went to high school. And so it's kind of my neighbor, my community where I grew up. And so I have a dog named Max, and he's very spoiled.
What kind of dog?
He's a rescue. He is a poodle mix. So he's about 21 pounds and loves table food.
Loves
particularly table food. He likes bacon.
Ah, and you found this out how?
Well, normally when I'm eating bacon in the morning, he usually just sits there. He rolls over, he whines, he complains. And so normally when he gets it, he's very happy.
Very good. How did you get involved in politics, Duron?
Well, I actually have been involved in politics for a very long time. I'm not very old. I'm actually currently the youngest member in the House right now.
May I ask how old you are?
I'm 28.
Wow.
I was elected at 27.
In a special election just a year ago.
In a special election in November of 2015.
All right. And so you enter the House at 27, but you said you've been involved in politics a long time.
Yes. I actually got involved. My first campaign was... a guy named Michael Brown. He was, at the time, was my state rep from South Kansas City. I was home one summer. I was about 14 or 15 years old. It was summertime, and he was going door to door. And my parents were at work, and I was home for the summer. And he knocked on the door and told me who he was. I said, my parents aren't home. And I told him that I was really interested in politics. And he says, well, why don't you come volunteer for my campaign? And I quickly moved from volunteering to doing a lot more than volunteering. And so... he lost that campaign, and he actually turned out. Actually, Michael works at the Mid-Continent Library in Grandview.
Oh, cool!
In Grandview, Missouri, and he lost, and he was a librarian at the Avila College. And so, when I went back, he decided to run again, and he asked me to be his campaign manager, and that was my start.
And you've never looked back.
I have never looked back. I have managed, before I got elected, I managed, was a campaign manager for about six or seven different campaigns from city council to county legislature as in several state rep campaigns.
But you somehow decided that running other people's campaigns wasn't good enough. You wanted to become the guy.
Well, yeah, it sort of happened, I wouldn't say naturally, but it just sort of happened. I had no plans of running anytime soon. My state rep at the time, Kevin McManus, who is now on the city council, he resigned to go to the council. And so when he resigned, it opened up a special election. And some folks had asked me to consider running. And I said, well, no, I'm not really interested. And there was when a special election, the governor has to call the special. And so no one thought the governor would call the special. And so it was either if he called the special, it would be like a 12-week campaign. If he didn't, it would be more like an 8-month campaign. I said, well, I'm not really interested in that. And he called the special, and so I got in, and we won.
Excellent. Well, I appreciate you being here. You're still the newest member of the legislature, of
yes.
the General Assembly?
Yes, I am. I've just finished my first session. I'm the newest member of the legislature.
Well, we're going to talk about that. But before we do that, across the holiday donuts from me here is Dylan Little. Dylan, let's start with you. What's on your mind this morning?
Yeah, I guess I'm really interested to, since you're a new senator, what the first year or the first session has been like. And I'm interested in hearing what your experiences have been like introducing bills. Or I saw that you proposed a bill about basically looking for people to who are politicians not to be working as consultants after the fact. Can you talk a little bit about that and where that is currently?
One of a lot of bills that were packaged and discussed as part of ethics reform in the legislature
right.
this year.
So, first off, I want to start back to introducing legislation. I am a Democrat in the majority Republican legislature. We don't introduce legislation. I did file a bill that would allow for folks who, it was not for elected officials, but it was for folks who work for elected officials. So this Kansas Star about a couple months ago did an article where the leading candidate for attorney general, who was also a state senator and chairman of appropriations committee, his chief of staff, was paid a salary from the state of about $80,000 being his chief of staff, and on the side as a political consultant made about $500,000. Working for special interests in different industries as a consultant. The issue becomes is that if you're not on the inside, you wouldn't really know this. So a lot of times as an elected official, yes, we sit on committees and yes, we vote on things, but our staff is what puts things before us.
Yeah.
So, for example, my legislative assistant, if you want to get on my calendar, if you want to make an appointment with me, if she doesn't put on the calendar, I'm not going to be there.
Yeah.
I mean, that's just the way it is because you have so much going on. And so the issue is becoming is that the legislators' assistants and their chief of staffs control the flow of legislation mm-hmm. and the direction of policy. And they have influence. In some aspects, they may have more influence than the elected official because they sort of set the calendar, they set the agenda, and you sort of follow to their tune mm-hmm. unless it's a really big priority, you know. And so that's the issue where it becomes because maybe – a senator may not have direct influence over something, but if my chief of staff is working on the side consulting for the tobacco industry and they have sure. legislation in my committee, then he or she may put it on my hearing to say, oh, we need to hear this. You know, this is important.
So that bill died in committee.
It never even got a hearing.
Never even got a hearing. And were you satisfied with the ethics reforms that did pass in this session of the General Assembly?
Well, not really. I mean, ultimately something is better than nothing. But I will say that I think that most people will understand the fact is that they passed a bill that allowed elected officials to not be political consultants. But the problem is that's not an issue.
Mm-hmm.
We're busy being elected officials. We're not political consultants. I'm not working for any other campaign other than my own to try to help someone else get elected or any issues. That's not an issue. It's a rarity that you see people getting paid, senators or reps getting paid as political consultants. And they also include statewide officers. When was the last time you saw Governor Nixon or Secretary Kander being paid as political consultant? It's not likely. I mean, it's very unlikely.
So you feel like the legislation was more symbolic than actual?
And that's exactly what it was. It was symbolic because people felt like we had to do something with the rampant things that were going on in the legislature. One good thing that did come out of this ethics reform was that now you have to wait a session before you can resign and become a lobbyist. Mm-hmm. We previously had no waiting period in terms of the revolving door. I could for example, my district could elect me in November. I could put my hand on the Bible and be sworn in January, and I could turn around February and say, this isn't for me, mm-hmm. and then be the chief lobbyist for some company
Whoever.
Tomorrow. And that was totally legal. And then what it does is it disenfranchises voters because, A, they have no representation, and, B, you all have to pay for another election to elect someone else. And my election, just to hold my election, costs Kansas City residents, I believe, $50,000 for one special election.
Mm. That election happened in November
of 2015. It was November 3rd.
You won a five-way primary. Mm-hmm. You got 56% of the vote. You took office, started in January. Did you feel like you were at a disadvantage among your fellow representatives kind of coming in new? They'd all been there a year already.
Yeah.
They had the seniority that you kind of had to just sit down and start working.
Yeah, because so when you get elected, they have formal things that they do. So one of the things that they do is they call it the freshman tour. And in the freshman tour, it's basically 2 weeks where they take newly elected legislators and they tell you basically this is how state government works. You do a tour of Missouri. You go to different cities. You do different – you look – you know, you tour different industries and manufacturing plants around the state.
And usually you've got a whole class of freshmen.
And you have a whole class that you do with your freshmen. And then they also do parliamentary training on – it's not like your regular Robert's rules. It's House rules, which are different than parliamentary procedure, because essentially the House sets its own rules. I mean, we set our own rules, and it's the same way in Congress and so on. Well, we didn't get any of that. They said they put your hand on a Bible, and they said, congratulations, Representative, good luck, Godspeed. And that was it. We had to figure it out. Now, I will say for me personally and my colleague who was also elected with me, Representative Roy Rowland from Independence, we were all elected on the same day. We will be at an advantage from our colleagues who are freshmen coming in this class, because we already have a session under our belt. And so due to term limits, we can actually be there 9 years versus the traditional eight, because this session does not count for term limits for me. My clock does not start ticking until January of this year.
I see. I didn't realize that. So you might end up as the most senior. You're the most junior member of the House now, but you might be the most senior before you're done.
Correct, because I would have technically I would have 9 years in the House versus eight.
And do you feel like, in terms of committee assignments, in terms of opportunities to exert influence, that you had the same opportunities as other representatives this year?
I was pretty lucky when it came to committee assignments, because as a freshman, you don't get very good committee assignments anyway. The other issue becomes, well, there's two things that play into committee assignments. So because of our numbers, you just get a lot more committees. So there's 118 representatives, and there's 43 Democrats. I'm sorry, there's 163 representatives. There's 118 Republicans. There's 43 Democrats. So there's so many committees, and so, you know, you may end up with five or six committees just because our numbers are so low.
Right, so it works to your advantage that's one of the few good things about being in the minority to that degree.
Correct, but the problem is that there's only three Democratic reps on each committee. So there's nine Republicans, there's always three, so you're always starting at a disadvantage in terms of votes. But I will say that what worked in our advantage was that, at least in my advantage, one of the reps in Kansas City who was in House leadership, who supported me, was very good to me and helped me get some key committee assignments that were very helpful for me in my first term.
Who's that?
Representative Gail McCann Beatty.
Oh, okay.
Who represents UMKC, actually.
Right. We've had her on the program. Dylan, what else is on your mind this morning?
Well, we talked a little bit about Jeff City, but just to bring things a little bit closer to home, I'm interested, Daron, in hearing what you think about libraries and the role of libraries in building community, especially in South Kansas City. It seems like there's a lot of developments happening in South Kansas City where it seems like we're at a pivotal turning point as a community. I would love to hear what you think about the library's role in building communities and building educational ecosystems within our communities.
Well, particularly, and let me just start with this. I will say particularly for Mid-Continent. Mid-Continent holds a special place for me because I grew up in South Kansas City. And so the branch on Blue Ridge, it was a branch that I quite often frequent. When I was a kid, before there were, you know, all the advances in technology, we would go there in the summertime and videos, and when they had videos, and there were things that I learned.
You're dating yourself.
There were things that I learned because of Mid-Continent Library in terms of access to quality of education. I mean, there were videos you could rent and things like, I mean, there were just things that I had, and even going beyond just Mid-Continent, I also, when I was in high school, Abilene University was near my house. And so I would quite frequently walk to the university and go to the university library and frequently, I mean, libraries have been a real big part of who I am and growing up. But particularly for my district, where I have that Redbridge Library sits in my district, Redbridge Mid-Continent branch. And they are redoing the Redbridge Shopping Center. It's getting an overhaul renovation. YMCA is looking at doing some renovations to their facility over there on Holmes. And I hope that Mid-Continent will be a part of that in terms of redoing and adding some space for the Redbridge. I actually had my first town hall, my legislative town hall at the Redbridge branch. We had 60 people there. And I now see the need for the renovation because the meeting rooms weren't big enough.
Yeah.
We ran out of chairs. And my thought is, the library should be a central part of our community. You know, I know when I lived in Washington, D.C., the libraries would host movies and they would host documentaries and things. And they had an auditorium. I mean, I think that that's what our library should be, hosting discussions and thinking outside the box, hosting film documentaries like the film that I saw they had in Jeff City, the Tale of Two Cities, I think it was, that PBS did about Kansas City. Yeah. And I just thought, that, you know, I think the library should be central conversation mm-hmm. around that. And I think mm-hmm. the Plaza Library hosted one of those showings.
Yeah.
So, I mean, I think those are key points as we talk about libraries and their connection to communities, because a lot of our seniors are using those computers mm-hmm. and things like that and learning how to use the technology. I mean, my grandmother went to the Mid-Continent because they had a class there on how to use iPads because yeah. she didn't know how, I bought her an iPad. She didn't know how to use it. She went to the library. They taught her how to use her iPad. So it's very convenient. And I think the libraries are becoming or trying to at least stay relevant to the times in which they are.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you're no longer reading videos, but now you're doing iPad classes, how to use your iPad, you know, so I think they're becoming relevant.
Do you think that, so where we are now, I feel like you have digital spaces where a lot of times people will be in kind of an echo chamber where they're hearing versions of their same voice.
Yeah.
Where we're at in the modern, you can call it the modern age, you can call it the digital age, is there a shortfall or a limited number of spaces where people with different opinions can actually come together and share different ideas and actually potentially leave with an opinion that's different than what they started with?
Well, I think that can happen. And I think that's the point of having information, and I think that's the purpose of a library. I think that they do that, I think, because a lot of times, you know, that's your early start of what we sort of are supposed to get in college. It's supposed to challenge your way of thinking and expand on ideas. And, you know, hopefully you meet people in a library that aren't like you and don't mm-hmm. think like you and think, okay, well, you know, that's an interesting perspective. And it may help you reevaluate your perspective on things. And I think that's the key point of a library. And I also will add to that is that another reason why I always advocate when we have these conversations about TIFF and developments like that, because, and don't get me wrong, I support TAC instrument financing for areas that are blighted. But I do not support those issues when you're talking about building parking lots on the plaza, because ultimately it hurts the libraries. It hurts schools and things like that.
Because those taxing districts are now not getting those dollars.
Correct. Mm-hmm. Correct. And I had a conversation with Jim in your office. You know, I think they said that they have lost about $2.5 million due to TIFs. I mean, that's something you could have added in yeah. programming for kids and for seniors.
Yeah, frankly, you brought it up in a very excellent way, but it's kind of like if you have everything's connected in our community where, you know, Mid-Continent Public Library, we're a library district that composes three separate counties and three separate counties that have obviously different agendas and different business proposals.
Correct.
That are contending with, you know, the property taxes that could, you know, seriously impact our ability to provide library services.
Daron, do you think we're making too much use of TIFF in the Kansas City metro area?
I would probably say so. I think that there are, and you know, you get in these boxes if you're, you know, are you for development or anti-development? I think it's more than that. I think TIFF should be used what it was created for. It, you know, and, you know, I'm going back to my graduate school days, you know, the TIFF is for that, the you know, the test of but for. But mm-hmm. for this TIFF, this development would not happen. You know, and I use the example of there are certain businesses along World Parkway who have gotten TIFFs. Well, you know, they don't need them along World Parkway.
Mm.
There are businesses, and I think a great example of a TIFF being used is Cerner. Bannister Mall was vacant. It was dilapidated. The site was really an eyesore to the community in Hickman Mills and Ruskin. Mm. It really was. The school district was getting very little revenue off of the property. But for the TIFF, which I think was like a $2 billion TIFF for Cerner, that corporation would not be there. Well, now you will have 10,000 jobs there. It's going to be a major campus. I think that is a ideal situation. It was a blighted community. When you talk about the building that they were talking about on 17th and Broadway or in the Crossroads, I don't think you necessarily needed a TIFF for that.
Yeah.
And I think you saw the citizen petition that rose up and, well, you know,
right, and in the end, that development did not happen.
Correct.
As a result of it not getting a TIFF.
Correct.
So that, but that's not a but for situation though, because mm-hmm. it didn't happen.
Well, right, and it didn't need it. I mean, it really didn't need it because
they just wouldn't have made as much profit.
They just wouldn't have made as much profit from it. I mean, and ultimately, you know, TIFF was really needed, and it's really developed for, you know, places that are blighted, like a lot of these folk places that are east of Troost.
Mm-hmm.
You know, we're having the same discussion about $27 million on 18th and Vine. I think TIFF would be a strong conversation. If not for the tax increment financing, you know, would these businesses necessarily be there?
Right. Well, let's may come back to that, but let me ask you about something else going on in the legislative season, which is that we're between the time when the session has ended and the veto override session in September. The governor, every few days, comes out with another package of bills that he has either signed or vetoed. One of those big ones this week, in the past, actually a little more than a week ago now, was Governor Nixon's decision to veto the permitless concealed carry legislation. It also included the Stand Your Ground legislation. That bill passed the House and the Senate with enough votes to override the governor's veto. What did you think of it?
Well, just put this in context for the listeners. The Republican majority had a really tough session. For them to have the supermajority that they have, it was a very tough session for them. They lost on the Religious Liberty Bill, which is SJ 39. They lost on paycheck deception, which would have basically required unions. Right now, if you are in a union job, you can sign up to have your union dues taken out of your paycheck. You do it; it's a one-time deal. You don't have to do it again.
Right. They referred to this as paycheck protection.
Yeah. Yes. They referred to it as paycheck protection. This would have required them to do it every year, which would have caused some sort of administrative issues for them. They also tried to pass a highway bill that did not see the light of day. So on all of their key issues, they had failed. And they, let be clear, they don't need us for anything, Democrats. They don't need us for anything. And at this point, I will say they had nothing to really show their base. I mean, it's an election year. Donald Trump is their nominee. They had to show something. In the last 4 hours of session, they pulled up Stand Your Ground, and they passed it overwhelmingly. It wasn't even on the calendar. They just brought it up, and that's what they pushed through. I envision that they will probably override the governor's veto because they have the numbers, and they have to show that they have done something.
Even after the Orlando shootings, because that happened after the session ended, after this bill was passed, before the governor's veto, you think that won't affect enough votes or any votes?
I don't think it will have much of an effect. I think the bigger effect will be, in my opinion, the Missouri Sheriff's Association has opposed this bill. The Missouri Prosecutors Association has opposed this bill. You have a lot of Republicans who are, you know, your law and order Republicans, and I think that may have more of an effect than anything else. But this legislative session, I can really boil down to the three G's. It boiled down to God, gays, and guns. That's what it boiled down to. Mm. And it was a real waste of time for the voters of this state.
You've assessed that as a failure for the Republican majority on most counts. To what do you attribute that? If they have the votes, they have the leadership positions, why were they not more successful, as you would see it?
Well, I think it's just, you know, what happens when you get too large and you get sloppy, you know? And let's keep in mind, in perspective, the Republicans have now been a majority for almost 16 years. They've had almost a majority in the state. So you have a class of Republicans who've never been in the minority. They've always been in the majority.
In both the House and the Senate.
In the House and the Senate. We lost the Senate in 1998, and we lost the Senate in 2002. So, and this happened to the Democrats. I mean, we got sloppy. I mean, we had the majorities, and we got sloppy. You know, it came to a point where we just started eating our young. You know, at some point you start to eat from the inside. And so that's the issue, is that I think, even though they have 118, there's two class Republicans. You have the ultra-conservative and you have moderate Republicans. Because your Republican, to me, in my opinion, your Republican in Columbia and your Republican in Eastern Jackson County of Kansas City is not the same Republican you have in Polk County.
Maybe
and,
Republicans in Kansas City's Northland as well in
yes,
that first category.
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. I mean, your Northland, Eastern Jack Republican and your Columbia Republican is not your same Republican from, you know, the Boot Heel. It's just not.
So I guess the question I have for you then, and we hear similar discussions on the Kansas side, obviously, where there's a pretty significant split growing mm-hmm. perhaps wider every day between the conservative and the moderate Republican factions in the Kansas legislature. Do you see something similar happening. That hasn't really been a structural split to this point in Missouri.
No, it hasn't. But I will say we have had some victories because...
You, the Democrats.
The Democrats, we've had some victories because they have just been split. Because, for example, on labor issues, you have some, even though they're Republicans, you have pro-labor Republicans. For example, my good friend Nick King, who is a very good friend of mine, he is a Republican from Northland, but Nick King represents Clay Como, the Ford, Ford Clay Como plant. So when it comes to labor issues, he has to typically be with labor because he represents the largest Ford manufacturing plant in the state. And it's, you know, it's those issues that you have to consider. And I think that the Republican majority is starting to see, I would say, the Trump effect happening.
So is this the kind of future that Missouri Democrats have to look forward to, hoping to kind of scrape together some victories by teaming up with some moderate Republicans? Or do you see any kind of resurgence for Democrats electorally speaking? I mean, we're approaching, we are in election season. We've got primaries less than a month away.
Before I got elected, I was a campaign manager. I told you in several elections, and I always look at things from a political lens. I will say, you know, there are several things. In the short term, yes, I think we've got to find our victories where we can, working with moderate Republicans who aren't crazy. I mean, that's just a simple, short, and sweet of it. But I think we've got to do two other things. We have got to, and I think the Kansas Democratic Party is having the same issue. I think they're in a little worse situation than we are. But as Democrats, we've got to start working on recruitment. I mean, that's our biggest thing. We left 66 seats in the Missouri House uncontested. We didn't file anybody. And it only takes 82 seats to get a majority. So they've already got 66 seats walking in. Mm-hmm. We've got to start recruiting candidates. I think we need to have a candidate in every race, even if we don't think we can win. And then the next biggest fight is in 2020 when we start redistricting. That's really where this comes. That is the root of all of this, is redistricting. Districts have been drawn and gerrymandered specifically to keep their majority.
But it's the legislature that draws the districts.
Well, yes. And if we can't agree, which we never will, it goes to the courts. The courts draw the maps.
So you think there is a chance that the Democrats could make some significant redistricting gains?
This state is not, in my opinion, this state is not a red state. I don't believe so. When you look at the fact that we now have 6 Republican congressmen and 2 Democratic congressmen from the state, they just drew congressional districts to X us out. And that affects the national level because obviously they want to have more members of Congress in their majority. But we went in 2008 when Barack Obama got elected, we had 72 Democrats in the House. It only takes 82 to get a majority. We were 10 seats away from majority. Today, we are now to 44. We have been bled dry just by pure gerrymandering.
Well, let me ask you about this, too. You mentioned all of the unopposed Republican candidates for the state legislature, but you're running unopposed as a Democrat in the 36th district this year, unopposed in the primary and unopposed in the general election. On the one hand, I guess that must be a nice feeling. You can relax a little here a month before the election. But does it concern you at all? I mean, you're representing 37,000 people that nobody will stand up on either side to
Well, I like to think it was because I did a good job.
we can accept that.
In all fairness, I will say, at the beginning when filing opened, I had 2 people who filed against me. They were Republicans. One withdrew, and then one was disqualified. And I don't know why, but they were disqualified, and the other just simply withdrew.
Sure.
But I did have an opponent. But I would probably have to say in my district is probably one of the more conservative districts in the city of Kansas City. The Republicans in my district consistently get about 40-41% of the vote. So they have a decent showing. If they work really hard, they could get 45%. Mm-hmm. 2010 was a bad year for Democrats. It was just that's when we lost the House. And in my district, the Republican got 46% of the vote, which is really high because my district is about a 60-40 district. So you had some Democrats who voted for a Republican. But I will say a lot of that comes from just the way these districts are drawn. Everybody wants a 90% Democratic or Republican district. Everybody wants that because they don't want to have to fight for their reelection. And I will say, coming out of a special election where you had 5 people, I think having to fight for an election, asking people for their vote, going to people you may not necessarily want to go to, I think it makes you a better candidate. I think it makes you a better elected official. I think having to go into the arena and be a true, you know, and I'm thinking of my scandal now, a gladiator, and, you know, and fight it out, I think it makes you a better candidate. I think it does. Because if you have a walk every time where you're not challenged, you're like, you know, then you don't, you're not as attentive to your district because you have no idea what's going on. The best poll I ever did was going door to door. That's where I learned most about my district. You can't pay a pollster to get to learn what you learn going door to door.
Are you a fan of scandal?
I am. I am a fan of scandal and House of Cards.
I'm always nervous when I hear about state legislators and people in government who are fans of House of Cards and scandal.
Do you have a favorite character in House of Cards?
I would have to say my good friend Frank Underwood.
All right. We'll let the voters ponder that. Maybe good that you're running unopposed, actually. Dylan, one more time around the table here. What's on your mind?
Yeah. Daron, I'm interested to hear. So you painted a picture that's pretty optimistic about Democrats, lean and mean Democrats in Jeff City having a chance to overtake the hubris of a Republican-led legislature.
Oh, no. I never said we had a chance. I know it's going to be
tough. Okay.
I mean, we'll have some pickups, but it won't. At this point, our greatest hope is that we can get to 52. 52 means we can sustain a governor's veto.
Mm-hmm. And so you're talking about 52 with the next election coming up?
Yes. We're at 44 right now, and if we can get to 52, that means whoever, if hopefully it's a Democratic governor, if he vetoes legislation, if we stick together, we can sustain the governor's veto.
Pretty modest goals, I have to say.
Yeah.
Yeah. That you just only have a 2-1, just slightly less than 2-1 disadvantage.
Yes, pretty much.
When you just thinking about being a Democrat and just the sheer numbers, how hard is it to fight the instinct to look at the session coming up and just from a numbers basis play from a point of just trying not to lose or just to stay alive?
Well, I mean, it's very hard. I mean, it's very disheartening. I mean, it's basically like you get up every day and you know the deck is stacked against you. You know, no matter how many, and I'm no mathematician, but I can count to 82.
Yeah.
No matter how hard you count, that the votes will never be there. And the other issue is that you have to remember, Democrats are not always unified on the same issues.
Sure.
So, for example, when you talk about issues of women's rights, you have some pro-life Democrats. And so we don't necessarily get 44 votes on all of those issues. And so you have to consider the litany of the issue and the coalition. For example, you have some Republicans who are for medical marijuana. And that's really interesting.
Yeah.
Which was an interesting vote as well that happened this session. So I think that the Democrats have a good shot, but I think it takes several things. I think it takes good candidate recruitment, and I also think it will take really on our end, we have got to do a better job of messaging what's happening in the state because Jefferson City is 2.5 hours. No one has any idea what we do. And then when you do find out what's going on, it's, you know, the Speaker of the House is sleeping with some woman who's not his wife. And I mean, and then it becomes just like, oh, well, what's going on down there? You know, and then everybody's concerned. So
So my last question is, we do have the veto override session coming up here in the fall. Is there anything you would expect that would be surprising coming out of that? Has anything shifted or moved? Do you see any surprises?
No, I think the biggest fight at this point is going to be the stand your ground law. I mean, to put this in context, we are the only state since Trayvon Martin who has passed that law. No other state has passed that law since Trayvon Martin. We're the first to do that. Also concerning is that we still don't have a prescription drug monitoring bill in the state. We also have not passed a highway bill in the state to fund our highways. Our highways and roads are in very much disrepair. I mean, our main function of state government is to fund roads, bridges, and education. And we're not doing either one of those.
I know a lot of Republicans are just as dissatisfied with, for example, the transportation bills not coming together as you are.
Well, the problem was is that even this session, the Republicans and in the Senate and Missouri Department of Transportation worked out a deal. They passed the bill out, went to the House. It never saw the light of day because the Republican majority did not want to have their members vote on a tax increase in an election year.
So it looks like we'll have to wait for 2017 for that.
Correct.
Well, I'm sure we'll still be here, and we hope you'll be back with us to talk about it at some point then.
I'm pretty sure I will be. There's donuts and coffee here, so yeah, I'll probably be back.
Absolutely, and you're unopposed, so yeah, we'll be around. Well, that is Representative Daron McGee, represents Kansas City in the General Assembly. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
And also our citizen guest, Dylan Little, works at Mid-Continent Public Library out in Lee's Summit. Thanks for being here, Dylan.
I think we've got to get Dylan a better title. Citizen guest just doesn't sound right.
Oh, I don't know. I think that's a noble
yeah,
position.
The nobility.
But you know what? We do have one more thing for you, Daron. Yes. We always try to get to know our legislator guest by asking them to choose our closing song. If there's a piece of music that you think captures this moment or the state of Missouri or the General Assembly session just passed, what song should we end with today?
Well, that's going to be an interesting one. I would probably have to say, since we've been talking about politics and the Democratic Party, I'm going to be very optimistic, so we can go with All I Do Is Win.
Yes.
All I Do Is Win. Who's the artist on that?
That's DJ Khaled.
There we go. All right. There's your choice. Thanks again to Daron McGee. Statehouse Blend is produced by Matt Hodapp. You can find us on iTunes or at kcur.org/statehouseblend. If you use Twitter, that's a good way to keep up on the show and the news from Jeff City and Topeka as well. I'm at PTS Brian, and my co-host Sam Zeff is at Sam Zeff. We always try to use the hashtag Statehouse Blend. You can find a shorter version of this podcast on the air on Tuesday mornings. That's part of Up to Date at 11 a.m. on KCUR 89. If you have any other thoughts or to be on the show as one of our guests, give me an email, brian@kcur.org. Thanks for joining us. See you next time. All I do is win, 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 no matter what. Got money on my mind, I can never get enough. And every time I step up in the building, everybody hands go up. And they stay there.